Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. The Church of Christian Commandment Keepers is on the air. And before I begin, I do have an important message for each and every one of you. You are unique, just like everybody else. So, with such profundities, I hope you'll be very edified. I'd like to give some good news about Kathy Schaefer. You've been praying about her, I hope. She's doing a lot better. She didn't have the two strokes. Actually, she had just the one, a mild stroke, and there is some trace of effects of it, but basically she's doing a lot better, and she's home, and she does appreciate the prayers of all of you, so thanks very much. And I mean, she's not, 100% of what she was, but she is basically fine. The problem is vision has been somewhat impaired, so you might, we should keep that in mind, but otherwise she's doing fine. We are enjoying the situation here in Central Florida. We've had rains. We've had nice sunny weather as well. Today we're going to get both, I guess, which is the way it tends to be here. We have a lot of sunshine, but we also have a lot of rain. But we need both. There's been a lot of crazy news, and I could comment on it, but if I did, I would be taking time away from a subject that's going to take a lot of time as it is, and I want to take the time to cover it adequately, though I probably cannot fully cover it in this one talk. Some years ago, I gave a talk in Pasadena, and I don't think it's online available anymore, from at least not from us. It may be still available under the auspices of some other organization, but as far as I know, we aren't sending it out because we didn't record it at the time, because we, in that sense, as we are now, didn't exist at the time as a corporate entity. But I called the talk Savoring the Third Commandment, because when you savor something, of course, you normally think of savoring as food. You also sometimes think of it in other ways, too, as savoring the moment. And I called it Savoring the Third Commandment because the Third Commandment is not directly related to food, but in a sense it is. And so if I haven't given that talk before, I'm going to give it now under the auspices of the Church of Christian Commandment Keepers, Savoring the Third Commandment. Because we are commandment keepers, and the basic ten are a basis for the rest. The Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, are a basis for conduct, as you know, a basic moral code. I'd like to go to 1 Corinthians 10. A lot of people might be willing to say, well, yes, we need to behave ourselves, we need to be good, we need to be ethical. But let's draw the line at personal habits or cultural activities. Let's draw the line there. But, if we're going to have a relationship with God, it's not just a matter of being good people, but we want to have a relationship with Him. And He is building a family, and He is building a community. And a community has a common culture. A community has common ways of approaching matters, problems. It has some its own kind of inspeak in a way too. People speak a certain way in a community, and they often dress a certain way, and they have entertainment that they enjoy, and so on and so forth. But what's really basic to community are events that they commemorate together. Like a married couple commemorates the anniversary of their wedding. People celebrate certain special occasions in a family. And nations celebrate national holidays that set them apart, as independent nations. For example, tomorrow is Flag Day in the United States. It's not a major holiday, but many Americans do pay attention to it, because in America, frankly, the culture here is where the flag is very important. Depends on the country. In the American culture, the flag is emphasized very much. Americans pledge allegiance to the flag. It's interesting. We say, we don't say, I pledge allegiance to the Republic. We say, I pledge allegiance to the flag and to the Republic for which it stands. I mean, well, what do I have to say the first part for? Because, as I said, in our culture, our national anthem is about what? The scenery? No, it's about the flag, the Star Spangled Banner. And we're singing about the flag. So that's the culture here. And we have a Flag Day. Not every country has one. Some others do, and this country does. But there are national holidays, and there are and diet is another way that people can be brought together as a culture. So the point I'm making is that God, in his interacting with people, has a way of setting apart people that are really serious about having a relationship with him. And there's a common culture that they have that ties them together historically with those who've come before, that ties them together with those who will yet come, that ties them together with people from around the world who are a part of God's people. In fact, I had said to turn to 1 Corinthians. I actually first want to turn to 1 Peter. I hadn't thought to even mention this, but I'm inspired to begin in this way, so I will. In 1 Peter, the second chapter, in talking about the church, Peter compares the church to Israel. Israel was to be a model nation, a church, but it also was an ethnic group. So the church in ancient times was based also on ethnicity. This is not the case now, but the church is based on a certain common culture. So Peter says to the church in 1 Peter 2:9, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation." He's talking about the church, but he calls the church a holy nation. "His own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people." You know, because we didn't start as a common people. We come from different backgrounds in the church. Who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. So the church, in a way, is a kind of nation. In certain respects, we have certain characteristics that a nation has. Now, frankly, each individual, in a way, has his likes and dislikes when it comes to food, and nations tend to have their likes and dislikes when it comes to food. And if you have Auntie Griselda over, you know, there may be not certain food you don't want to give to her because she finds them repugnant. Well, now, what if Jesus Christ were invited into your home for dinner? Is there any foods that he might find repugnant that you might not want to serve him? You know, if you go to Revelation 3, he talks about coming and eating with people. You know, Jesus Christ says in Revelation 3:20, "Whenever I knock, you know I'm where I'm going, what verse I'm going to. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come to him and dine with him, and he with me." Well, is there certain food you would present to Jesus Christ and he would say, "Yuck, you know, that's not for me"? Well, the fact is, yes, there is. And so there are lines that most people draw. And Jesus Christ has drawn lines, not only for himself, but for those who would have a relationship with him. In other words, he even has the temerity, he even has the audacity to guide us and direct us in terms of eating, and also drinking, for that matter. What do I mean drinking? What I mean is, number one, we don't consume blood. You know, we don't drink blood. I know right now vampires are the in thing, but it's forbidden. And we also don't get drunk. Now, wine, yes. Alcohol, yes. But drunkenness, no. So we're not supposed to drink to excess. So, you know, that's just something we don't do as Christians. We don't get drunk. But in 1 Corinthians 10, which I finally am going to read, verse 31, it says, "Therefore," 1 Corinthians 10:31, "whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God." So even when you eat or drink, you want to do it in such a way that you're glorifying God. And God actually has certain lines he has drawn. Certain things were not created for human consumption. For example, Gideon is playing with some kind of a millipede or some kind of beetle, some kind of big bug, a ladybug. You know, now this is very entertaining and all for him to play with, but it's not something that, now he'll put it in his mouth later as a baby. You know, that's the thing. A baby will put anything in its mouth, but we're not supposed to be that way when we get older. We're not supposed to just put anything in our mouth, you know. Certain things, or if we do, we spit them out. We don't eat them. We don't eat those things, you know. And so that is the point. There are certain things that God did not, for whatever reason he made them, I do not know, but he didn't make them to be eaten. But I'd like to go into that a little bit today, and I'd like to first comment on the fact that when Christ came, he didn't come to undermine what he had already commanded his people to do. I mean, God has come into flesh. So what's he going to do now? Psych. I didn't mean what I said back then when I gave you the commandments. That doesn't make a lot of sense, right? You know, so if you go to Matthew 5, when Christ came, here's what he said. Now, this may not be what you heard growing up. in whatever church you attended, but this is what he did say. Matthew 5:17. He says, "Do not think I come to destroy the law or the prophets." Oh, I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. "For assuredly, I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or one tittle will by no means pass from the law till all be fulfilled." To put it in modern language, you know, not a dot of an I or the crossing of a T will pass away till all be fulfilled. So he didn't come to undermine the law. However, he did come to undermine, you could say this, a body of tradition that had developed, a complex tradition that had developed that had, in effect, distorted the law. There had been a fanaticism that had come about regarding the Sabbath, and he wanted to reform that. Now, we have here Gideon near me, and we don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, right? Now, the fact that he came to reform the Sabbath didn't mean that he came to do away with it. Now, another thing he came to reform was the eating practices of Orthodox Judaism, and which I used to observe as an Orthodox Jew. We had certain rituals regarding ritual washing before eating. It was important to us. Now, there is one tradition that we were not so picky about except on Passover. There's a tradition that before you dip certain foods into certain liquids, you have a ritual washing of the hands. Now, any of you who have attended a Seder may know there's this one part of the Seder where there's a ritual washing of the hands, and then there's a dipping of greens into salt water. Well, the ritual washing of the hands was something that was a custom in ancient times. You know, before some food was dipped in a liquid, because of ritual defilement, you had a ritual washing of the hands before you did that. What was more important, in which became a law, was that before the eating of a meal with bread, you begin the meal by eating the bread. Before you ate the bread, there was a blessing you recited before eating the bread. But before eating the bread, you had a ritual washing. Your hands needed to be clean, and then you had the ritual washing, and then there was a blessing you recited, and then another blessing over the bread, and then finally you ate. So there were two stages to the eating. There was the ritual washing and the benediction, and then there was the benediction over the bread, and then then you could eat. You know, so these rituals were important to the Pharisees, and Orthodox Jews still observe them to this day. But Christ said that they don't have to be a part of Christian living. We don't have to be concerned with such things. In Matthew 15. In Matthew 15, I'm not going to read the 20 verses, but there's 20 verses here that discuss the issue. But I'm going to go to the beginning. Matthew 15. Then the scribes and Pharisees who were from Jerusalem came to Jesus saying, "Why do your disciples trespass the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." Now, first of all, even if they did wash their hands, if they hadn't done the ritual, it would still not be good. It's not just a matter of washing the hands. There's a ritual form of washing that was required, and they didn't do it. And he went on to discuss the issue with the Pharisees, and I don't want to go into all he said, but I do want to go to verse 17. He said to his own followers, "Do you not yet understand that whatever enters the mouth goes into the stomach and is eliminated?" Let's say that your hands are dirty even. You know, let's say you eat with dirty hands. So what? You know, your body, your nature takes care of that. You've studied those things, or you know about them anyway. Okay? But what's important is what comes out of the mouth, not what goes in. "But those things which proceed out of the mouth come from the heart, and they defile a man. For out of the heart proceed evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witnesses, blasphemies." And some people think these kinds of things are funny. You know, many a comedian makes jokes about some of these things. But, you know, I don't want to get into that. "These are the things which defile a man, but to eat with unwashed hands does not defile a man." So you see what the issue is here, eating with unwashed hands. Now, the book of Mark discusses it as well. And in Mark 7, we have a discussion of the various ritual washings of the Pharisees, and they had ritual washings of pots and pans. I observed those things too as a younger person. There were ritual washings of people, and ritual washings of plates, and ritual washings of hands before eating, and those sorts of things. And these things were not part of God's law, and did not carry over when Christ came to bring the New Testament. These practices did not carry over from Judaism to Christianity. And in Mark 7, Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now when they saw some of the disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, they found fault. So here we go again. You know, it's the same, it's a parallel account. And here, let's go again to what Christ answers. And here's where he's instructing his own disciples. Verse 18 of Mark 7. So he said to them, Are you thus without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him? So if you bring in some dirt, you know, it's just physical dirt. It just goes in, you know, one end and out the other, as it were. Because it does not enter the heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods. Now some translations say, you know, thus he said this, cleansing all foods. So he made the comment saying, in effect, that all foods are clean in terms of this requirement. You don't have to worry about eating any food with unwashed hands. It does not defile the food and then therefore defile you. You know, so the issue is eating with unwashed hands. If you read the passage, that's the issue here. And he goes on to say, and he said, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within and defile a man. So, you know, he's saying whatever you eat with unwashed hands is not an issue. Now, is there any discussion here of Leviticus 11 or Deuteronomy 14? Has anybody accused him of eating that which he's forbidden to eat? You know that he never sinned in his whole life. The Bible tells us that. He wasn't even accused ever in all of the Gospels of eating anything forbidden. You know, so this issue is not even about forbidden foods. Which means what? That there are, in fact, forbidden foods. And I'm going to give you a history of the instruction of forbidden foods and the practice, and talk a little bit about that, because there are divine dietary laws, and we Christian commandment keepers do keep them. They are God's laws, and we do keep them. Now let's go back to what God first told Adam and Eve. Did he care about what they ate? The first commandment that we know about that they violated, let's say the first sin of human beings, involved eating something they were not supposed to eat. In Genesis 2, I don't want to go into a lot of background on this. You know, let's put it this way. All of you who are listening to me know that years ago, this section was discussed. And so I don't want to take a lot of time with it. But in Genesis 2:15, then the Eternal God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Eternal God commanded of the man saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it, for in the day that you eat of it you shall surely die. So the first commandment that they violated was that one. You know, dress and keep it they were supposed to do, and various other things. You know, there's not the only commandment here, but it's the one that they violated. Let's go to Genesis 3. Verse 10 of Genesis 3. And so he said, I heard your voice in the garden. Here Adam is talking to God, because God manifested himself to Adam and Eve. He interacted with them. He spoke to them as a teacher to pupils, or as a father to children. He actually interacted with them in that way, as Christ later did. So he said, I heard your voice in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. So it wasn't God who first hid himself from people, but people who hid themselves from him. And he said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? And so that was the first sin, was eating something they shouldn't eat. And so then the man said, the woman, you know, that's the way we are, blame the woman, right? The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. And the Eternal God said to the woman, what is this that you have done? So then what did she do? And then she blamed the devil, you know, the snake that had convinced her. The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. And so, you know, here we go with the first human sin. So you could imagine that God wants to train us to not to eat what he says don't eat. I mean, this is something basic. Are we going to listen or not? Or are we going to say it's none of your business what I eat? Well, I mean, he created the universe. He created whatever is edible. He created us and our bodily needs. He created the foods that are there. He has the prerogative to tell us some things were made to be eaten and some not. Let's go back to the days of Noah. That's a long time ago. Noah knew about the dietary laws. Just as in Genesis 7, all right? We're talking here about the great deluge, the great flood of Noah. Then the Eternal said to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation." Now, did Noah know about the dietary laws? Let's go back a few verses and see what it says about Noah. Genesis 6 and verse 9. This is the generation of Noah. Noah was a just man, okay? Perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Oh, he had a relationship with God before the ark. Before God asked him to build the ark, he had a relationship with God. And perhaps God walked with him as he did with Adam and Eve. Maybe in the literal sense, he appeared to him and discussed things with him. Or in any case, he had some interaction with him. And very likely he revealed to him or discussed with him these dietary laws. As we'll see in a moment. I'm going back now to Genesis 7. Genesis 7 and verse 2. "You shall take with you seven each of every clean animal." Oh. "Male and female, seven pairs of those," see, "two each of animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also seven each of birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth." So he tells them from clean animals take seven pairs, from unclean animals take a pair. So there are clean and unclean animals at the time of Noah. Now why do you want more clean animals? Obviously, because they're what you're going to eat them. I mean, not right then, but later. You know, so you want to have plenty of them around when the ark lands and it's time to repopulate the earth. You want to make sure there's plenty of animals around that you can eat. That makes sense to me. Now let's go to Genesis 9. Now in Genesis 9, when they land, some basic things are covered. You know, one thing is not to eat blood, which I've already commented on. Now this is not an issue of having an operation and having a transfusion. It's a matter of sitting down to a meal and having blood. And what you're going to eat or drink that day, you don't do that. But as far as having an operation, having a transfusion, first of all, that's human blood. Here we're talking about the blood of an animal. You know, that not to eat the blood of an animal. Obviously, you shouldn't eat any blood. But I mean, this is not a matter of eating when you're in an operation and having a transfusion. Anyway, let's go on to what he says in Genesis 9:3. Now, he said, "Don't eat blood." Now, that's very popular in some cultures. It is quite popular in some cultures. It's not popular with God, but in some cultures it's quite popular to eat blood or drink it. Genesis 9:3. By the way, I've noticed something about this culture. I've lived a long time, and I've noticed that as the culture has tended to become a bit more coarse, we're also emphasizing more the eating of things which people in the past would not think about eating. It seems to be the in thing. In a lot of animated movies, to get a rise out of the audience, they show people eating very grotesque things. And there are special TV programs where people go around eating whatever they can find, you know, in effect, as we say, to use street language, to gross people out. But I'm noticing more and more of that tendency. And maybe that's all part of this vampire craze, too. It seems like as the society is getting more coarse, we're getting into the concept of just, you know, seeing what you can eat that's the, you know, the grossest thing that you'd never want to eat and then eat it. That seems to be just, you know, emphasized more and more. They even had a contest here in Florida, or maybe it was in California, if you had to eat something, some bug or something, in order to win the contest, as I recall. One of the theme parks or whatever, as I recall. Anyway, let's go to Genesis 9 in verse 3. "Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs." So just as you can eat plants, you know, you can also eat animals. Now, is every green herb edible? No. You know, some plants are not for human consumption. Now, that's something that God doesn't reveal. It's something that you just know from nature, from science, from the fact that there's an immediate reaction. You eat something that's no good for you as a plant, you'll get sick or you'll die. And so we know to avoid certain things right off. Now, when it comes to animals, again, just analogous with plants, there are some animals that are not for us to eat. However, there, it is not that obvious. It's more subtle. You don't automatically get sick and die if you eat certain of these animals that are forbidden. However, God reveals to you, to us, in His Word, what animals are to be eaten and what are not. You know, so it's a matter then of faith, saying, okay, I realize with plants, I can figure out for myself, don't eat poison mushrooms or you'll die. But with certain animals, you know, obviously I won't drop dead as soon as I eat whatever, say a crab. But God says that's not something I should eat. So it's a more subtle matter, but for whatever reason, He says don't eat it. Now, it may not necessarily be a health issue. There are other factors involved. But we have the faith to trust that's not something that He meant for us to eat, so we don't. I'd like to go now to Genesis 26. Do you think Abraham obeyed the dietary laws? Well, look what it says about Abraham. You can read all about Abraham in the Bible, and you'll see certain things that he did or didn't do. But if you look at Genesis 26, there's obviously more instruction he received that we don't necessarily have written down. But he received more instruction than what we know. And very likely he knew about the dietary laws. Because look at Genesis 26 and verse 5. Look what it says about Abraham. Because Abraham, Genesis 26, 5, obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Well, how many of them do we read about in the life of Abraham? So this indicates that he knew that Abraham had more instruction than what we know. And very likely it did include the dietary laws. Now in the book of Leviticus, a very powerful point is made. And it's a cultural point. Some things are creepy, crawly things, and they, you know, if you think about it, a lot of people don't want to eat them anyway. But, you know, there are some that are gray areas, you know, and each culture is different. For example, evidently Maasai are perfectly willing to drink blood, but they don't want to eat a fish. You know, so there are cultural matters here. But there are certain things that God's people, because they are God's people, you don't in effect wallow around in the mud and eat certain things that are creepy, crawly, low things, you know, culturally. You don't eat them. In Leviticus 11, now the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. And he gives instructions. Here's what you are supposed to eat. And he gives them instructions. Now notice how he words it. Well, this is a matter of ritual. I just want to make sure that you don't, you know, mess with goyim, you know, and so I've given you these extra things. You know, that's not how he puts it. Look at Leviticus 11, verse 43. That's where I'm going to jump into the account. You shall not make yourselves abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, nor shall you make yourselves unclean with them, lest you be defiled by them. For I am the Eternal your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. See how he puts that? That's very strong language. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Eternal who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. So he makes a very major point of not eating certain things, because it is godlike to avoid them. Now, Peter knew those verses. They had a very powerful impact on Peter, and he quotes that verse. Now, do you think he quoted that verse and forgot what I read? He knew the context of the verse. I'm going to quote read what Peter wrote. This is in 1 Peter 1. I'm going to start in the 13th verse of 1 Peter 1. Therefore, gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, and rest your hope fully upon the grace that is to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ, as obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts. Now, it's not only sexual. You know, some people lust after certain foods, you know, and they just can't be told not to have them. Not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance. Now, in a lot of cases, they don't know any better either. I'm not out here condemning people for eating things that they don't know are forbidden to them. I'm not making a big issue and getting all fired up at people who don't know any better. But that, you know, we have the Bible, so we do know better. But he says, as obedient children, not conforming yourselves to the former lusts, as in your ignorance, but as he who called you is holy, you also be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, be holy, for I am holy. So Peter quotes these verses, but he knew quite well the context of the verses in Leviticus 11 when he quoted them. Now it goes back to a principle of don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain, which you find in Exodus 20 and you find repeated in Deuteronomy 5, and I want to go there. That's why I called this talk when I gave it many years ago, Savoring the Third Commandment. The Third Commandment actually involves not eating that which is forbidden, because when you do, you actually are taking God's name in vain. The book of Deuteronomy is laid out based on the Decalogue. It's laid out based on the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are given in the fifth chapter, and then every few chapters until you get to the end of the 29th chapter are basically, the 28th chapter roughly, are basically elaborating on those ten. You could see, for example, the Sabbath is talked about as the fourth commandment, and I hadn't planned to do this, but I will. The Sabbath is talked about, that's the fourth commandment. Now you go to Deuteronomy 15, and it's talking about the sabbatical year, canceling of debt in the seventh year. And then you go to Deuteronomy 16, and it's talking about the annual holy days, the annual days of rest. Just like you have the weekly day of rest, you have the annual days of rest. So Deuteronomy 15 and 16 are elaborating on the fourth commandment. That should be obvious. Well, Deuteronomy 14 is elaborating on the third commandment. Now, I try not to be a boring speaker, but I've put my grandson to sleep. But anyway, hopefully the rest of you are still awake. Let's go to Deuteronomy 5. Now, he woke up. All right. I opened my big mouth. All right, let's go to Deuteronomy 5, and let's go to verse 11. You shall not take the name of the Eternal your God in vain, for the Eternal will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now, I understand that commandment is violated all the time. In fact, I'm really getting annoyed because practically every time I turn on the TV, now maybe it's my fault, right? I shouldn't watch it, or almost any time I see people just in business and in education, whatever, constantly people are taking God's name in vain, or they're doing it euphemistically, one way or the other. But we're not to take His name in vain. Now let's notice Deuteronomy 8 and verse 10. By the way, that was the third commandment I just read, of the third of the ten. Let's go to Deuteronomy 8 in verse 10. It says, when you have eaten and are full, then you shall bless the Eternal your God for the good land which He has given you. So thank God for what He's given you. When you've eaten and you're grateful, you thank God for it. Well, now wait a minute. You're going to thank God for food He says is forbidden, that he forbade you to eat? You're going to thank Him for that? Isn't that crazy? Thank you for this garbage that I'm putting in my mouth that you don't intend for me to consume. It doesn't make any sense. So in Deuteronomy 14, in elaborating on this principle of don't take the name of the Eternal your God in vain, God talks about, not eating certain things. You, Deuteronomy 14, you are the children of the Eternal your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead. You don't mutilate your body in certain ways, especially for religious reasons. You don't go out of your way to do things to your body, especially not for, as I said, in order to think that somehow you're being more devout by doing that. For you are a holy people to the Eternal your God, and the Eternal has chosen you to be a people for Himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. So obviously, if you look freakish, is that a way to honor God? And unfortunately, maybe I hadn't planned to necessarily say this, but it's coming. I hung around a lot of very religious people and, Hasidic people. And yet, to many people, they really look weird. Their heads are shaved virtually. Their hair is very, very short on top. And they have long side curls. And sometimes they're so long that they twist them around their ear, or they put them up, and put a hat on, and they have them kind of up on top of the head, and that sort of thing. And it's weird. So now people think in order to honor God, you've got to have this kind of special haircut and look weird. You have a beard and a shaved head and practically in long side curls. I don't want to pick on them, but, that's my background. I'm aware of that. And so by trying to be real devout, in a way they're almost doing what it says not to do. It's kind of interesting. And then it goes on to say, verse 3, you shall not eat any detestable thing. Oh, so as part of that also, as part of being God's people and not taking His name in vain, people shouldn't be seeing us eating what, crud, you know, eating things we God says you shouldn't eat. And he goes into it here. You know, now, if you people who've done a study of the Bible can tell you that domestic fowl, you know, we eat domestic fowl. We don't eat what we might call birds of prey. But on the other hand, we should be willing to eat crow. But only metaphorically, only metaphorically. All right, so anyway, so what I'm trying to say is that the book of Deuteronomy in the 14th chapter, which gives the food laws, in effect is elaborating on the principle, you know, don't take the name of the eternal your God in vain. Now, let's go way into the future now. Let's go to the book of Isaiah, the 66th chapter. Here we're talking about way into the future, end time prophecy. And are animals still unclean, that were unclean in ancient times? When Christ died and was resurrected, did that change the nature of animals? Did swine change? Did lobsters change? Did beetles change because of Christ's death and resurrection? Isn't that, you know, I hate to even say those words. It's so absurd. But in the prophecies of Isaiah 66, we're looking now into the far future, Isaiah 66. You look at the context of 65 and 66 of Isaiah. I'm looking at the third verse. He who kills a bull is if he slays a man. He who sacrifices a lamb is if he breaks a dog's neck. Now in Korea, people eat dog. Dogs are forbidden for food. I'm not condemning the Koreans. They don't know any better. But I'm just saying, you know, we don't eat dogs. He who sacrifices a lamb as if he breaks a dog's neck. He who offers a grain offering as if he offers swine's blood. I'm on Isaiah 66:3. And he who burns incense as if he blesses an idol, just as they have chosen their own ways and their soul delights in their abominations. So you see that these are called abominations to God, these kinds of things. Even in Isaiah 66, which is talking about the far future, let's look at the 17th verse of Isaiah 66. Those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens after an idol in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse, shall be consumed together, says the Eternal. So it's condemning idolatrous practices, which also involve the consumption of foods that are forbidden. And this is talking about, you know, this is in an end-time setting if you read the context here. Now let's go to the end of the Bible. You can't get past the book of Revelation. That's it. You're backed into the, you know, you're at the end of the story. And not only that, you're at the end of the book. I'm going to late in Revelation, Revelation 18. So I'm near the end of the entire Bible. There's not much of the Bible after Revelation 18. So let's go to the end of the New Testament, Revelation 18. We're at the climax of human history now in the account. I'm not saying we are now literally, but in the account we are. Revelation 18. After I don't want to comment on where we are chronologically one way or the other. After these things, this is Revelation 18. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. Oh, so here we have unclean and hated birds in the book of Revelation? Yes. You know, as I said, the nature of animals has not changed because of Christ's death and resurrection. So what was forbidden when he came remains forbidden. Now, Peter understood that, and so even when God told him to eat unclean food, he didn't do it, because he knew that God, that's not what he meant. He couldn't have meant that. God doesn't tell you to sin. God doesn't tell you to violate his own law. So when God seemingly was telling Peter, eat something unclean, he said, no, you can't mean that. And in fact, he didn't mean that. Now, see, it was safe for God to give that vision to Peter, because he knew that Peter wouldn't take it the wrong way. Let's go to Acts 10. The Apostle Peter sees a vision. He's praying and he sees a vision and he gets hungry. In verse 11, and saw heaven open, this is Acts 10:11, and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth. you know, not necessarily things that anybody eats, except maybe, you know, Bushmen in the Kalahari and so on. But in it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And a voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." So Peter said, "Well, been thousands of years of history gone by, but if that's what you say, I'm going to do it." No, you know, of course not. But Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I have never eaten anything common or unclean." And a voice spoke to him again the second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." This was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. So now he's thinking, what does God mean by this? That he's, you know, what does he mean by this vision? He's thinking about it. "Now while Peter wondered within himself what this vision which he had seen meant, behold, the men who had been sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate." So we see that the men who came to him were Gentiles, uncircumcised Gentiles, and yet they were about to enter the new covenant. They were not going to become Israelites. They were not going to become circumcised and become Israelites and then receive the new covenant. They were going to go directly from Gentile status to converted status. This is revolutionary. And that's why such a revolutionary vision was given. It's like taking unclean animals and making them clean. It's that drastic a thing. So Peter now understood the vision. The vision was not about eating. The vision was about Gentiles becoming part of the church. And so that's why he just gets so excited in Acts 10 and verse 34. And he says, "Then Peter," Acts 10:34, "opened his mouth and said, in truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him." So now the vision was to tell him Gentiles can become directly part of the church. And in verse 47, they began to show signs that God was working with them in a miraculous way. Then Peter answered in Acts 10:47, "Can anyone forbid water that these should not be baptized who have received the Holy Spirit just as we have?" And he commanded them to be baptized in the name of the Lord. Then they asked him to stay a few days. So he continued to teach them. So here we have the beginning of the church among the Gentiles, begins with Italians, and of course it goes on to then every nation. And so that was the meaning of that vision, and Peter understood it. Now the Bible does show us, you know, what can be eaten and what cannot. It also instructs us to be grateful for what we receive, to thank God for it, to praise Him for it. And so we have prayer in connection with what we eat. Now, unfortunately, over the years, people have developed their own traditions about food. And it's interesting that how people can respect being a vegetarian, being a vegan, being on all kinds of diets. You know, there's various diets. I don't remember the new ones, but there was the Pritikin diet, and there was the South Beach diet, and there's this and that diet. And yet if you say, well, I don't eat what's forbidden in Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14, you know, then they read every other kind of thing's okay. But if you say that, you know, then everybody gets all riled up about it, you know. But the Catholic Church used to forbid people from eating meat on Friday. It was considered a quote-unquote fast, and you had fish on Friday. You didn't eat meat on Friday. Then there are some religions that forbid alcohol entirely. You know, you have to be a teetotaler in those religions. You know, you have those kinds of traditions about food. In fact, it was a very popular joke when I was a child, which wouldn't be funny now, but when I was a child, people laughed. It had to do with a Jewish fellow who joined a Catholic organization, and they were trying to figure out some way to kind of ease him out. They felt uncomfortable. Everybody else was Catholic, and there was this one Jewish fellow. So finally, they got together, and they said, "I know what we're..." Somebody said, "Hey, let's have a banquet, and let's serve ham." So the Jewish guy raised his hand and said, "Let's have it on a Friday." You know, and people laughed when I was a child at that joke because Catholics weren't supposed to eat meat on Friday. There's actually a better story that probably a lot of you have heard. It's about a rabbi and a priest that go to a conference, and it's lunchtime, and they serve ham as the main course. And so the rabbi's kind of feeling awkward. So the priest is sitting next to him, and he begins eating his ham in front of the rabbi, and he says, "It beats starving." So then the rabbi says to the priest, "Well, okay, see you later. I'm going home to my wife. It sure beats ham." You know, it's a better story. but anyway, let's go to 1 Timothy 4. Because, you know, there are all kinds of traditions about food. But, you know, the concern is, what does God have to say about it? In 1 Timothy 4, now the Spirit expressly says that in latter times, this is what 1 Timothy 4, some will depart from the faith, giving heed to deceiving spirits and doctrines of demons, speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their own conscience seared with a hot iron. So he's talking about, as time goes on, ideas will come in that are not biblical. Forbidding to marry. You know, well, I don't want to go further with that. You know, I don't want to necessarily, you know, make an issue. Forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. In other words, you're knowledgeable. You know what God has created. So you know there's certain, you know what is forbidden and what isn't. You don't have to listen to what people tell you, you know, what is or isn't forbidden. You look in the Bible and see, right? For every creature of God is good and nothing to be refused if it is received with thanksgiving. For it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. So foods are set apart by God's word as permissible, and you also pray and you thank God for them. You know, and so those foods are permissible, even if somebody else tells you, well, you know, you can't have this, you can't have that. You know, that's their problem. You know, God's word lets you know what you can have and not have. You go by God's word, and you also thank Him for it. You pray as you're eating the food. So I would hope that I have portrayed in this overview that the dietary laws, the divine dietary laws, were there, you know, all through the centuries. They were given to Israel as a model, not necessarily intended to be specifically for Israel. Eventually, they're going to apply, you know, to everyone. And as we understand them, and as we, you know, study the Bible and we understand them, then we can keep them, and we can, in that sense, develop a common culture. One of the elements of which is diet. You know, there are, in that sense, divine dietary laws. I'd like to go to the book of Revelation. As we go to the end of the end of human history, we find there is a church in existence, and the church are followers of Jesus Christ in Revelation 12:17, and they keep the commandments of God. So the two of the characteristics we find about the church, of course, they have. Well, I'll just read it. Revelation 12:17, those who are persecuted. Because they are in the church, persecuted by Satan, who's pictured as a dragon here, as he was, he came as a serpent in the Garden of Eden account. In Revelation 12:17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring. And what is their characteristic? You know, who the descendants of this woman, who is the church, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. So the church is distinguished by being the Church of Jesus Christ and also by keeping the commandments. By the way, I think I see I have a little bit of time, so I wanted to make a comment about the name of the church, because that is also a theological question people ask about. If we're going to be together as a community and be Christians, you know, we should want to be known by a name that is biblically sound. You know, we don't want to take a label that would be a wrong kind of a label. So let's just notice that, first of all, 12 times in the Bible, those who are part of the Church of God are simply called that, the Church of God. But is that the only thing they are called? The Church of God is not the only thing they are called. For example, in Galatians 6, in the sixth chapter, I'm sorry, I want the 16th verse. Is everybody on 616? And as many as walk according to this rule, peace and mercy be upon them and upon the Israel of God. Now remember, Israel is a title that was given to Jacob and then to his descendants because he was one who overcame with God or was a prince with God, Yisrael. So really in that sense, the name of God is in the name of the nation, Yisrael, you know, he who overcomes with God or he is a prince of God. But we're talking here about spiritual Israel. As I said, the church is not based on ethnicity. It's based upon your relationship with God, having his spirit. So he talks about the church as the Israel of God. There was, for example, a church in South America that called itself, translating from the Spanish, the Israelite Church of the New Covenant, which isn't a bad label. They call themselves that. Now let's go to Romans 16. Now this is also in the 16th verse, Romans 6 and verse 16. Greet one another with a holy kiss. The churches of Christ greet you. So here the churches are called the churches of Christ. So you see, there isn't just one name by which the community is called. In Acts 11:29, let's just go there since I seem to be going with this subject. Let me just do one more scripture on this. In Acts 11 and verse 29, Acts 11:29, the Pharisees called the church Nazarenes. Why? You can look at that in the Bible as well, because they followed Jesus of Nazareth. That wasn't a complimentary name. They called us Nazarenes because they were saying, we're following somebody from Nazareth. That's not necessarily a compliment, you know, but that's what they called us. And they still call, I mean, in Hebrew to this day, that's the name, a Christian is called a Nozri, a Nazarene, going back to that time. But in verse 29, what did the Gentiles call them? They called them followers of the Christ, of the Messiah. I'm sorry, I want verse 28 of Acts 11. I apologize. Pardon, 26? Okay, I want to go back a couple of verses. Then let's go to the 25th verse, Acts 11:25. Then Barnabas departed for Tarsus to seek Saul. Verse 26. See, my wife is a librarian. She does excellent research, even on the spot. Then Barnabas departed for Tarsus to seek Saul. And when he had found him, he brought him to Antioch. Are we all there? Now, Antioch, here we're talking about people who are not Jews predominantly. So it was, for a whole year they assembled with the church and taught a great many people, and the disciples were first called Christians in Antioch. So they had been called Nazarenes by the Pharisees, and now they're called Christians in Antioch. They're called the Churches of Christ in the book of Romans. So they're called the Church of God in many places. It's called the Israel of God in another place. Now let's look at Revelation 3. At Revelation 3. And here, Christ says to the church in Revelation 3 and verse 8, I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength and have kept my word and have not denied my name. Well, who is talking to them? Jesus Christ is talking to them. So if you want to make a big issue about the name, you know, you could say they are the church of Jesus Christ, and they've not denied his name. You know, so the reason I bring up these issues is because, and in a right way, people do labor over this. You know, what do you call yourselves? You know, you know, how do you present yourselves to the world if you're God's church? And it is an issue, and it does have to be thought about. But I believe if you put all the verses, all the Bible together, Christian Commandment Keepers is a legitimate way, you know, that we can label ourselves. It seems to make sense to me as an appropriate way to label ourselves. I'm not saying it's the only term to use, but it does seem to be a legitimate term to use. And I would like to then go back to my main thrust today, which is the third commandment. Don't take the name of the Eternal, your God, in vain. And keep that by also, in your diet, glorifying God in your diet, in how you eat and you drink. And one way we do that, of course, is by obeying the divine dietary laws in Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14. Following the example of Jesus Christ and the apostles. And now I want to go to Revelation 14:12, where it's talking about the church. These people are called saints in Revelation 14:12, so they are spiritual brothers and sisters because they're saints, and that's what we hope to be, saints, people who are righteous people. And in Revelation 14:12, It says, here is the patience of the saints. And how are the saints defined? Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So when we get to the end of the story, we have a definition of the saints. They're those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So we indeed follow Jesus Christ. And one of the ways in which we do so is by keeping the dietary laws, as I said, of Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. And thus, by doing so, we are, in fact, savoring the third commandment. Well, thanks for listening, and thanks for listening regularly. And I appreciate those who are also sending us communication and encouraging us in that way. We do appreciate that. So in the meantime, then, enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. And have a wonderful summer. All the best to you and yours.